Thanks for joining us. This is another episode of Life in Jiu-Jitsu. I'm really happy to be able to introduce Chris Campbell to this episode. Our last episode was with Tyler Bray over in Rockland, California, and he was, I think, a pretty inspirational guy in his own right, but just shared with us some of the folks that he found inspirational and who sort of inspired him to push on and push through adversity. Chris, you came up.
Amazing.
You know, you came up. He, you know, Tyler, as you know, doesn't have, was born with spina bifida and does not have full control of his legs, right? Nonetheless, wrestled in high school, became an amateur bodybuilder, power lifter. He just posted a clip on Facebook today. He's benching 395 pounds. He weighs 150.
More than I could.
Yeah. And has not really let anything kind of hold him back. And he was sort of talking about this sort of culture of perseverance in grappling and jiu-jitsu and in wrestling. Your name came up. And I'm going to be honest. I'm kind of embarrassed to say that I didn't know your story. Okay. You know, and but he told it on the last podcast. And he's like, and here's the thing. He's just a few hours away. So, you know, and these are strange times that we live in. But one of the benefits is that people, you know, we can just reach out and connect with people quicker than you otherwise might be able to in the past.
Yeah.
So here we are. So I understand that you're the oldest American to ever medal in wrestling at the ripe old age of 37 years old.
Yeah, I was 37. I think it was, so the Olympics were in August, and so I was about a month away from my 38th birthday.
Wow.
In Barcelona.
In Barcelona. And you, that was the 92 Olympics.
Yeah, I was on the 1980 Olympic team.
Right.
Where there was a President Carter boycotted those Olympic Games.
Right.
And I didn't get to go. That was when I was in my prime. I was 26. And so I was at the top of my game then.
So you, it's quite a long layoff.
Yeah. You know, what I did was I'd always been a vegetarian since 79, so I had always sort of watched what I ate. I was really into yoga, and I liked running and weightlifting. So because then I also tried to make the Olympic team in 1984, and so I was training up through 84, and in 84, the week before the Olympic trials, I tore my ligament in my knee.
Oh, goodness.
So I didn't make the 84 team. And then I went to law school, and I figured I was done through 84 to 87. And then I got a job with United Technologies Carrier Corporation, worked there for about, in Connecticut for about 7 months. And then they moved me to Syracuse, New York, where Carrier was located. And Syracuse, New York had a wrestling
team. And they got a wrestling team there.
That's right. And I had a kid named Mark Kerr, who you might know from some mixed martial arts.
Oh, yeah.
And and Mark Kerr was, you know, just needed some direction. And so I started to go to wrestling practice at least 3 days a week.
Yeah.
And then I was noticing, okay, wait a minute. I'm running every morning. At lunchtime, I go out and I weightlift. And then on the evenings that I'm wrestling 3 days a week, you know, this is...
You're living like a competitor.
Yeah, that's my training schedule. I said, maybe I could try to compete. So I think it was 90. I came back out. I think it was 1990. So from 84... I was done until 90, came back out, and I was second in the nation.
Wow.
Was I second? What's it? No, actually, I think 80, maybe 89 I tried, and I didn't make the team. I did pretty well. I think I was second in the nationals, but then they had the world team trials, and I got blown out in the world team trials by a guy who, like, a month before was so weak that I could easily beat him by about 12 points. And then all of a sudden, it was like, this guy was a rock when I was wrestling and just crushed me.
Really?
It was quite a startling change.
Well, you won't say it, but maybe I will.
Who knows?
Yeah.
He was committed, right?
Yeah.
So then in 1990, I trained again. And this was, I think, all under the rug is what I would call it, because my company didn't know about it. And I won the nationals, and then I was second in the world. And when I got back in town, my boss said, you know what, you were second in the world. And we as the corporation think that maybe you should focus on that, because if that's a gift you have, we don't want you to waste it. So Carrier Corporation started to sponsor me. And
what a tremendous opportunity.
Yeah, it was really neat. I worked with some really nice people there. And that was completely different, because let me give you an example. As a wrestler, when we went to the World Championships in, 77, went to the World Championships, we slept in a barn on hay because we couldn't afford, hotels and all that stuff. This is with the old AAU. It was terrible. It was horrible.
Oh, my goodness.
And now, in 1990, I'm staying at five-star hotels wherever I'm training, and I have a total rental cars, and if I want to bring in 10 guys to train with me, I bring them in to train. And so it was really different. A lot of fun, but really different.
Do you I'd like to just maybe talk about that contrast a little bit. I think it was maybe Sugar Ray Leonard. One of these famous boxers had lived like a really austere lifestyle, even though he had amassed quite a bit of money in prize fighting. And a reporter asked him, hey, you're still driving the same car, you're still living in a studio apartment. He says, well, hard to get up and jog at 5 a.m., if you're in silk pajamas.
Yeah.
Having seen having slept in the barns, and then also being sponsored by a large corporation like Carrier, and the different treatments, do you feel like you lost anything in the austerity, or maybe it facilitated you training in ways that the previous lifestyle could not have?
It was just the opposite.
Yeah.
When I was training in 1980s, sort of when I was in my prime, nobody was paying us any money. I can remember at one point being on food stamps. It was very, very stressful.
And as one of the top wrestlers in the world, yeah, on food stamps.
Yeah, and I was getting hurt all the time. And so that's at like 23, 24, 25, 26. I'm getting injured all the time, and I'm so stressed out. And then when I'm 35, right? So yeah. We're talking about 10 years later, and I got this company paying everything for me. And for me, it was love to go. So going running, I would hate to miss running, so that I don't care if I was in the Taj Mahal, I would go out running in the morning, or weightlifting. That was like the best parts of my days. So I could just train as hard as I wanted to. I never got hurt. And that's the one thing I noticed.
Yeah.
So it was really pretty interesting.
You had the right food in your body. You were able to take care of yourself. You were probably a little bit less stressed.
I think it was the stress.
Yeah.
I could totally focus on training.
Yeah. When you...
So maybe there's a certain level...
Like a curve.
Yeah. Yeah. If it got too rich, then it would ruin me, but...
Yeah.
Money definitely helped.
But, that's interesting. That's a valuable perspective. I see a lot of that with like up-and-coming MMA fighters. Mm-hmm. A lot of the process of getting ready for an MMA fight is kind of like a resources game. Mm-hmm. If you're running away from the dogs of poverty, very difficult to put together the right type of nutrition, and then to travel to the places that you need to travel to get the different the looks at the different techniques and the different instruction, right?
Yeah.
However difficult that is in just in one sport, in a multifaceted sport like MMA, I think oftentimes you do see the folks with the access to the better resources wind up winning, right? Because that's ultimately access to better instruction. There's so much to cover here. I'm struggling, but can you talk to us a little bit about your sort of how you got introduced to wrestling and sort of what made you want to wrestle? We were talking earlier about you did some football, wasn't for you, and you started wrestling about ninth grade, is my understanding?
Well, actually, the first year I ever wrestled was in fourth grade. So my town, Westfield High School in Westfield, New Jersey, was a really big, big time sports town.
Okay.
And so they had this Pee Wee wrestling program.
Okay.
Really, really nice program. And so we started producing a lot of wrestlers. I wrestled one year in fourth grade. Didn't wrestle again until ninth grade. And I can remember, I think it was when I was in ninth grade and I had wrestled a little bit, I was sitting in the bleachers watching a wrestling match, a high school wrestling match. And I saw this guy do a switch, which is really a simple wrestling move, but it just looked like magic to me. It looked so beautiful. It was like art. I was like, I got to do this, you know? And so that was when I fell in love with wrestling. And from that moment on, that's all I wanted to do. And so I was a Jehovah's Witness, so my mother wouldn't let me wrestle because she wouldn't sign the permissions to wrestle my junior year in high school. So I went to junior college and every day worked out with the junior college team.
It was actually maybe an advantage.
Maybe. So come my senior year, for some whatever reason, and to this day, I don't know why, she decided to sign it. You know, and so she signed it, and so I went on and I won the states and then, you know, went on and I actually... I was second to nationals for freestyle nationals as a high schooler, and I lost a guy named Mark Johnson, who I would eventually beat at the nationals in college a couple of years.
Got it.
He was a great guy. He was a Greco guy too, really strong in that art.
Right.
And I was a freestyler. So
when you, I had listened to a couple of interviews with you in preparation, and it sounded like you didn't actually get to compete until your senior year, but you'd been just training for several years up until that point. What was that like, doing training with no hope of competition for several years?
Again, it was an opportunity to. I love wrestling, and you know, I would wrestle. It's like one of the neat things about being on the 1992 Olympic team was me, Kenny Mundy, Kevin Jackson, got John Smith, got Bruce Gumwagner. We would wrestle anywhere, anytime, any place. We didn't care if it was practice. We didn't care if it was anything. We just wanted to butt heads. You know what I mean? Didn't matter. So that was the cool. That was the way I was. You know, it was. Yeah. I don't care. I'm wrestling.
Yeah.
You know, when I go into competition, I had a definitely different sort of frame of mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So where'd you wrestle in college?
I wrestled University of Iowa.
Iowa, right. Yeah. You were not originally recruited by Iowa, though.
Right.
Is that correct?
That's right. I wasn't recruited by anybody.
Yeah. Why do you think that was?
Well, it was because I didn't wrestle until I was a senior. I don't think anybody knew about me. And then then the word got around that my mother was a Jehovah's Witness, and she might not sign a letter of intent. So I don't think I really got any good looks. I think I was recruited by some local, regional wrestling semi-powers, you know, like I think Wilkes-Barre, they had a fairly good wrestling program for a small college.
Okay.
And Maryland was another one, University of Maryland, which is a Division I, you know, big-time college program, but they weren't good.
Yeah.
So, but what happened was I was recruited by Montclair State, and there was, I forget the coach's name is Rich, I forget his last name, Softman, I think it was.
Okay.
They were recruiting me, and so when I told them that I wasn't going to Montclair, that I was going to, I told him I was going to go to Maryland, he said, Chris, I can't let you do this. I'm going to go talk to this guy named Gable, and we got to get you in the program because you just got way too much talent to waste doing that. And so you need to go out there. So when Richie said that, for whatever reason, I was like, okay, I need to go to the best place. I had a car that I had bought working in gas stations. I sold my car, got a plane ticket out to Iowa, got a factory job working on the Iowa floor during the summer.
Okay.
And I went to their practices, and then I walked on my freshman year at the University of Iowa.
This summer of like 75, 76?
73.
73.
Yeah.
Okay. So you... you know, 73 now, I think the civil rights era was only 10 years, was 64 was the 60, right. It was the big year. And then, and it was only 10 to 13 years past much of, what had happened in the American civil rights era. Right. But we're still struggling.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
What was that growing up? Like, I mean, you know, wrestling is oftentimes, very dominant in rural communities.
Yeah, yeah.
It's associated with a very conservative sort of ethos in American culture.
Yeah.
Did you face any discrimination, or do you think you got treated any differently, or was that something that you had to battle?
You know, my hometown Westfield was sort of, you know, you had people who lived on two different sides of the track. So on one side of the train tracks, you had all the rich guys who went to Wall Street for banking. On the other side of the track, you had all the people who cleaned their houses. And so my mother cleaned houses. But they had a high school. It was for high school. It was a neat high school with a bunch of neat people. I don't think I ever felt really discriminated against in high school. Or in the town of Westfield. In that perspective, it was like the whole town, the whole culture was, we want all of our children, black, white, yellow, green, to achieve as much as they can, and we're here as a group of people to make sure that happened. That's the way I felt in Westfield. I don't think we live in that environment anymore. I think it has gotten a lot more toxic, and I don't think people are willing to help. So in that respect, there has been a change. Now, with respect to the civil rights movement, it was some very interesting times for us because, as you can imagine, when children are having dogs sicked on them by, police for marching, that can create a great deal of anxiety and in both ways. So like a lot of the people in our town were black people in our town was like, well, hey, don't be causing trouble, right? Because you're going to get...
Why are you stirring the pot?
Yeah, you're going to get stuff on us. And then other people say, well, we got to make progress. So so I was aware of that going on, but I was in a culture, in a society where they wanted everybody to do well. And that was, I see now, a remarkable time that I lived in.
Yeah, that is remarkable. That's like a little island in time and space, right? And was it the same at over at Iowa?
No.
That's what I had heard. What was that like?
Well, as a New Jersey kid, going to Iowa was just total culture shock.
Yeah,
totally
on a different. Number of different levels, right? Urban, rural.
Yeah, exactly. And cultural, I don't know. Everybody goes to the bar and drink a bunch of beer. I mean, that was the thing to do in Iowa. That's not what we were doing in Westfield. I'd say that wasn't fun.
Sure.
It had its challenges for me. It was very tough. But as I look back on it, I would have walked through fires to be able to be coached by Dan Gable and the assistant coach Jay Robinson and in that program I was in. So it was certainly worth any of the negative that went with it.
Well, Gabe, from what I understand, you and... You were Gable's first NCAA title winner as he was
his first national champ and his first world champ.
Yeah. And so I'd heard a funny story that you kind of antagonized him a little bit. You kind of had to make yourself known. You told him, "Hey, I'm going to kick your butt."
Oh yeah, I can be really stupid that way if you want to hear the story. He came and spoke actually right after the Olympics. He came and spoke at a high school. And so I'm this brash, 12th grader walking up to him saying, "You're not tough," "I'll kick your butt."
Can I say you were aware of your own talent?
I wasn't aware of my limits. And then when I go out, I get my plane ticket, go out to Iowa. We go to the gym the very first time we practice. And I'm like, "Come on, I want you," and those are really the last things you want to do to somebody like that, right? So I said, "Okay, let's go." And I took him down right away, within maybe 5 seconds.
Just right off the whistle.
Right off. Took him down. That was quick. And then for the next hour, he beat me to death. I mean, we'd have things like arm bars and so forth, so that I had, if you know Matt Burns, I had...
Oh, yeah.
All the skin off the left side of my face was gone. All the skin off the right side of my face was gone. I felt like both my shoulders were dislocated. He pretty beat me up. So that was an interesting lesson.
Man, he was that good as a coach.
He was incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I know Dan.
You can't
Dan.
Even say it. You can't. Yeah. You can't. I can't tell you how great he was as a coach. It's not describable.
Not even just good as a coach, but he was also, the best wrestler in the room at that time.
The best and the meanest.
Yeah,
man. But I mean, he never came out. I mean, you just knew. For example, if you took it easier practice, and he said, "Okay, let's go." I mean, you knew you were in trouble. I mean, you could see guys who go with him because he wouldn't let you rest. They'd be trying to crawl off the mat. He'd pull the guy's ankle, pull it back on, and start beating him up. And so, I mean, he would never yell at you, but if you did something wrong, you may have to practice with him.
Yeah. Do you and Dan have? Like a little bit of a special relationship since you're his first major Big tournament winner like that, or?
You know, I thought we did. I mean, we didn't always, me and Dan didn't always get along.
Yeah.
But I think we always had that competitive drive kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of what he had wore off of me. So, I mean, I think he recognized that in me. And on that level, we got along really great.
What levels didn't you get along on?
Well, I do think, you know, I am, how would I say it? I'm like a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in a certain way when it comes to, like, you know, the rights of minorities and so forth. You know, I'm not the type of person who will say, oh, let's go along, get along. I'm the type of person who will say, you know what, this is wrong and we need to have this changed.
It's time for change.
Yeah, so, and Dan is not that way at all.
Well, you're also perhaps living a different experience than Dan was, since you're black and he's white, right?
Yeah.
He might not understand the fierce urgency of now.
Yeah.
In the way that you do, because he's not black, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you say that about a lot of people.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think therein was a little bit of our friction. And then, you know, I would get lazy a little bit from time to time. And, of course, that's not acceptable to Darren, which is perfectly reasonable.
Okay.
I was really focused, and then I got a little unfocused, and then I got back focused again when I started my international stuff. But so... So, I mean, so we had a little disconnect on those levels, but...
Yeah. You know. He, yeah, I get that. I could see that being very frustrating. What was your treatment like by the fans and the rest of the team? Were you the only black guy on the team?
I don't know if I was the only black guy. There was one or two. Iowa fans, for the most part, were pretty good. I mean, you know, yeah. I got called niggers once or twice. you know...
Did that stir anything up in you?
I mean, you know, anger. I'll tell you a story about Iowa. So here's my anger thing. And this is what sort of gets me when people talk about, well, you know, everything is fair and everybody has an opportunity in this country. I decided I wanted to go to law school. So I was, well, let's go back. So I was trying to figure out how to train because I just graduated from Iowa and I needed to make some money. So I was a bouncer at a bar. And so we had a downstairs bar and an upstairs bar. And so this upstairs bar had like a disco setting. And I realized, you know, it was really neat. But nobody went there because, you know, the culture of Iowa is you go to the bars and you drink beer. And so the downstairs bar, they were two separate bars, was really, you know, had a lot of customers going in. Upstairs bar, nobody.
Hmm.
So, and I was the bouncer. So I said to the manager, wasn't even known, I said to the manager, look, you give me the worst night that you do business, and I'll show you that I'm going to make a profit for you upstairs. He said, okay. And so, you know, I went out and I knew that nobody was catering to the black tastes in that area and culture. So we bought a bunch of albums. I got flyers out and so forth to get people to come to this event. And so the Tuesday night I had got a DJ. The Tuesday night came and the place was packed. And it was so busy that I had to jump behind the bar and help people, you know, sell alcohol to make money. And I mean, and it was standing room only. This is a Tuesday night. And so at the end of the night, the manager came up to me and says, well, we can't do this anymore.
Oh,
I said,
goodness.
Why not? He said, well, we didn't make any money. I said, there's no way we didn't make any money. I had to get behind a bar to sell extra drinks. We made money. He goes, well, I'll tell you. I saw a white guy come up. He took one look and then turned and went back the other way. So I can't have it because he's scaring away our white business. And so for me, that was very angry because that was the point when I said I had to go on food stamps. That was the point when I had to go on food stamps because I had gone broke and that was sort of what was going to make it for me. So then I said, okay, well, I'll keep going. And I was I was studying for the SATs, or LSATs, for the law school exam.
Right.
At the time, so there was a police job came open. So I applied for the police job. And so you had to take a physical test, you had to take a psychological test, you had to take a written test. All right. So we did the physical test, and I was so far above everybody else there. It was really obvious.
All back,
right?
Yeah.
Because I was like at world-class training level. We took the psychological test, and then took the written test. And so I didn't get the job, and I came back and I said, well, you know, why didn't I get the job? And they said, oh, you flunked the written test. And I said, I flunked the written test? You know, that's really interesting. And so then I called up the employment department or whatever for the state. And then they came back to me and well, first I got this offer to be a police by the offer for, of the job by the police. But at the, by that point I was afraid and I didn't want to be around people with guns who didn't really want me around.
Yeah, that's so fair. Afraid. And maybe not respond to your call to help if you're out there on your own.
Or shoot me.
Or shoot you, yeah.
So I didn't accept the job. I mean, then they came around, they came to me and says, well, you know, Chris, what did they tell you? I said, they told me that I flunked the test. And they said, well, you know what? You got the highest score of the test on it, of anybody. And then I laughed about it a little bit because I said, if they would have told me I'm a wrestler, if they had told me I flunked a psychological test, I would have never questioned it, right? I mean, I said, okay, fair enough. But it was the wrong test. So
you so, flunked me on the wrong test. Yeah,
those two things happened to me back to back, and then I got angry. And I think I was angry for about a month. And then I realized, you know what? I'm angry. But all these people who've denied me these opportunities, they're not losing a little
bit of sleep. Yeah.
You know, they're not sort of being angry with their wife and had a wife and she had a child at the time, sort of like you.
No.
And so I said, well, you know what? I just got to let this go. And so that was sort of my experience in Iowa with respect to those issues.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, anger, not a useful emotion in the hearts of young men.
Yeah, well,
you know, it can consume you.
Yeah,
right?
Well, anger is very dangerous.
Yeah.
But, and you can see it, but in everything in the world. But,
And so while that was all going on, you were wrestling the whole time.
Trying to make the 77
Olympic. Okay, so this is after you had graduated college.
Yeah, it was like. Months. Well, yeah.
And so after you graduate college, you're hanging around Iowa trying to figure out what your next step is and also still trying to make the Olympic team.
Yes. And so what happened, right after that happened, a guy named Willie Gatson, who was a wrestler at Iowa State, heard that I was struggling. And me and Willie were competitors. We wrestled in the same weight class. And so he talked to Harold Nichols, who was a coach at Iowa State. And then they offered to pay me $400 a month to come up there and coach.
Hey, that's something.
That was great at the time, you know. So I went up there and went to Iowa State and took some courses because Harold Nichols is always really demanding that if you're here, you're going to continue to educate yourself. He was a great man that way for all of his wrestlers and his coaches. And so that gave me the opportunity. So when I was there at Iowa State, I won the world championships. That was in 1980 when I made the Olympic team, you know, beating out the defending Olympic gold medalists and through that period.
So you were, you'd held a win over the defending gold medalist. You're fairly certain you're going to win the gold if you have the opportunity to compete. I mean, nothing's ever certain, right?
But. Exactly. There was nobody who could have, well, I won the world championships the next year, but there was nobody who could do what I could do at the 1980. I could have gotten caught, but absent getting caught by a move, nobody was going to beat me.
Right. I'd heard that they'd there was previously not a tech fall rule.
Right.
And they sort of implemented one out of mercy because you were just tearing through the competition. Is that right?
Well, you know, that's another funny story. So through the 77 to 1980, they have what they call a stalling call. And so you get called for stalling, warn, and then you get for another stalling, is another point, another stalling, another point, another stalling, 2 points they'd give the guy, and then they'd kick you out. And so what I found was in every close match I got, and I was being called for stalling all the time. And I was losing matches not because the guy could take me down or beat me. I was losing matches because the refs were stalling, calling me for stalling. And so at that point, I had to face it.
Because they could.
Decision, huh?
Because they could. Because it was in their power to do so. And
yeah.
You probably were not actually stalling.
Oh, I don't know if I wasn't actually stalling. I mean, I'm sure I was stalling it sometimes. But, yeah. I mean, when you're beating a guy up, it just seemed to be fundamentally unfair for me to be penalized because I'm beating him up. So what I decided to do, I said, okay, I can either quit or I can just start beating guys by 10 points. And then it won't be any issue. I decided to start beating guys by 10 points. And then I started training a lot harder and got my technique. And so, you know, one of my first matches against one of my nemesis was a guy who was always beating me on these stalling calls. And I beat him 23-6, I think it was.
Oh, my goodness.
In the Olympic trials. And it was all because, you know, and it was kind of funny. So they had three three-minute periods. So after the first 3 minutes, I was beating him like 11-2. And the refs had called me for the two warnings and the 2 points. So
the next one, you get kicked out.
Kicked out. And they, so they were clapping, actually. And they came over to me and they go, hey, the next stolen call and you're out. Now, I had taken the guy down. I had thrown him. I had arm thrown him. I had tripped him. I had done everything but killed a man in the first period. and they were going to call me, caution me out, which was unreasonable. And so, and then people started to boo. And that was the first time they got that reaction. And then, so then I continued to beat him, to, like I say, 23-6, and he didn't wrestle anymore after that. It so destroyed him because, I think he realized it just wasn't
for
close.
Him.
And then I beat John Peterson was the defending Olympic gold medalist. I beat him like 10-2. His 2 points were the stolen. Eddie Bannock, who was a 3-time national champion, Olympic gold medalist, I beat him. He was my closest. I maybe beat him like 11-5 or 6 or something like that. But everybody I beat, but I got at least 10 points over. After that tournament, then they sort of laid off me. I got a feeling that the national coach came up and said, listen, this guy's wrestling at such a level, he's going to be, you know, really produce for us in the world. So, you know, lay off a little bit. So that was sort of my stalling story. And getting into really what I would say top shape, fierce fighting shape in the 81 to win the world championships.
Yeah. There's a...
make the Olympic team, actually, in 80.
Yeah, you're an Olympian.
Yeah.
The there's a sort of like a social and political overlay over the 80 Olympics because we did not participate and you didn't have the opportunity to compete. Yeah. Can you explain that for folks? I mean, that was a little bit before my time. I understand Jimmy Carter pulled us out, but I feel like you probably have a better perspective on that.
So... if you can imagine this, the Russians were invading Afghanistan. And because for whatever reason, I don't know whether it was for the oil money, if they were trying to get some oil routes or whatever, the United States decided that was a problem. So Jimmy Carter asked the United States Olympic Committee to boycott the Olympic Games. And they refused, which they should have done. They should have refused. And then what he did was he said, well, if you go to the Olympics, we are going to take away your tax protection status.
Oh, wow.
And basically destroy you as an Olympic organization. And after they made that threat, after Carter made that threat, then the Olympic Committee decided to go along and boycott the Olympic Games. So whenever I see a picture of Jimmy Carter, I make sure I give him the finger salute. That's what happened with the Olympic Games. And it was crushing for me because I had trained really hard, and that was everything to me, everything. And I think some of your fighters may know what I say when I say it was everything to me.
Yeah.
I'd be willing to die for it. And this guy took it away with no second thought. And it's really such a tragedy that we're in that.
It was really a political move, right?
Like, it's all politics, right?
Yeah.
And here's what really bugged me. They put the Olympics on TV, so it wasn't like he was barring CBS or NBC or whatever from showing it.
Were you sitting at home watching it?
Oh, hell no, I wouldn't watch
it. You couldn't watch it?
No. So, you know, basically he picked on the people that were vulnerable who couldn't fight back. He was a bully.
Well, the was the Russian invasion of Afghanistan at that time period really such a big deal? We went back and we invaded Afghanistan ourselves just 20 years later.
That's what I'm saying. It was so ironic, right?
Yeah. Have you looked back on it? Have you looked back on those matches now?
You know, my matches in like 1980.
The matches in your weight class?
No.
You haven't looked at them now?
No. I don't know who won in 80. Who won in 80? Somebody I beat in 81.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you couldn't bring yourself to watch that bracket unfold?
No. No.
Yeah.
No.
That's tough. That's really tough. Yeah. When you had left Iowa, University of Iowa.
Yeah.
And... you were getting ready to compete for the Olympics. How did your training change? So you were doing folk style wrestling, right?
Yeah.
It's your folk style to freestyle. And so, actually, you know, if I could just kind of maybe put this in context for, I suspect the majority, I'm actually not sure who's listening aside from my own mother. but just to sort of maybe put this in context for folks who are listening, the American wrestling system, the collegiate wrestling wrestlers folk style system, which I think has some elements of mat wrestling. You get some more time on the mat, you're rewarded for standing back up, and it's I actually think it's more of a holistic wrestling system. But the Olympics fight under freestyle rules, which is it's really just takedowns, right? It's just takedowns, then you got 20, 30 seconds to turn the guy.
Well, it's takedowns, but it's also throws.
Throws, yeah.
So, for example, where I can pick up a guy and slam him to the ground, and if you do it what we call folk style, which is college style, if you slam a guy, you get penalized. In freestyle, if you slam a guy, you get rewarded. So they had a, and when I did it, it was just beautiful. It was a beautiful sport. They've changed it now. Okay. Which is really depressing to me, especially that we're doing mixed martial arts, because what we were doing back then was so much closer to what they do
in mixed martial fighting. Arts.
Yeah.
Can you explain the rule change in freestyle wrestling? My understanding is like you actually get more points if the guy's feet go over his head or something like that, right? Like the better the throw, you get more points.
Yeah. Right? So we call them like souffles when you're doing an arch back, and I don't, you know, or hip toss,
yeah.
And things like that. You would get if his feet fly in an arching motion, and you take him to his back. I don't know if it was 3 or 5 points. I forget what the points were.
Got it.
But and also in freestyle, you couldn't go to your back. So if you went to your back at any time, that would be points. Mm-hmm. And so you had to be careful about it, unless you were doing a throw. But the techniques were totally different, because in folk style, you could sort of from time to time wrestle on your back without giving up points.
Mm-hmm. Like a tilt or something like that?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah. It's hard to sort of explain
sure.
verbally. But freestyle is a lot faster, and when I did it, they required you to have your head up, so you couldn't. If you see wrestlers, you'll see wrestling today, and they're really low to the ground. I call it rat wrestling, where they have their heads real low, because if you block with your head, then you can block a lot of leg attacks.
Almost like John Smith type of style.
Exactly. Right? Yes. Yeah. Exactly. That's what I call rat wrestling. John was
your favorite rat
wrestler. Yeah, he's my favorite rat. Absolutely. Yeah. But in 1980 and before that, you had to keep your head up and you had to contact a guy. And so you had to walk into him and do arms. So it made for example, we would have matches that would be like 23 to 17, you know, with arm throws.
Oh, just throwing each other.
Spins, trips, you know, all the beautiful stuff of the martial arts.
Yeah.
And that's all gone now because they went to the rule allowing the guys to lower their head. It's so depressing.
Got it. Yeah. So the rule change was that you used to have to have your head like above your hips or something like that. Or?
Yeah, you couldn't block with your head. If you see wrestlers, they get in a wrestling stance.
I've seen it. Yeah,
it's a good stance. Well, you couldn't block with your head. You had to keep your head up, and so your contact was through the arms, which is more like a fighting situation.
It is more.
Because who's going to put your head down, right?
Not in a fight. Not in a fight. No.
And so
it's almost more like theory at that point, right? Like,
Yeah.
There's a lot of. There's a lot of gamesmanship of the rules that I'm actually really sort of depressed about in the sport of jiu-jitsu. Because jiu-jitsu does allow you to, I mean, frankly, almost encourages fighting on your back.
Right.
It's actually much harder to define a rule set, because you can't say, oh, there's points for going to your back. Like, right. Well, I wanted to be here, right?
Right.
So a lot of the way that the rule sets are defined are sort of like who initiated the move. Mm-hmm. So like if you're sort of like on top of me, I'm not going to get positions for reversing positions and winding up on top. If it was if you attempted an arm bar but wound up on bottom of me. So then the ref has to make these really subjective calls of who initiated the move. And I think that's like not really in the spirit of fighting, because you'll have the winner of the match be the guy who spent, you know, 90% of the match on bottom. You know, but not be able to effectively put up a submission, you know. Yeah. And then also there's just a lot of just like sitting right down to your butt in jiu-jitsu, which is, I think, just painful to watch, and also not in the spirit of fighting, you know. How did you change up your training regimen from folk style to freestyle? Did you feel like all that time you spent like mat wrestling, like under the prior rule set, Did you feel like that helped you? Do you feel like it was maybe kind of wasted?
Well, that
I hesitate to say that, wasted, but
I think it really is a to do folk style and then have to switch to freestyle to wrestle internationally really puts American athletes at a tremendous disadvantage because it is a different style. And when I did it, when you had to keep your head up, then there were a whole sort of because in folk style you could put your head down, so there was all sort of upper body hand fighting that you didn't know. I mean, so what I had to do to train was, there's a guy named Dan Chandler, who I think was the best thing I ever did. He was a Greco-Roman wrestler, and he coached at Minnesota. And you know, one of the things my coach Jay Robinson told me, you know, always make sure you learn from everybody and go seek out the best to learn from. And so I went to Dan Chandler, and I spent time with him for a week training on just upper body hand fighting.
Wow.
And that's why I decimated people in the Olympic Games, the Olympic Trials in 1980. Because before they, you know, they would get me for stalling because they would underhook me and push into me, basically, to prevent me from shooting on them. And then I get called for stalling. Well, they couldn't underhook me anymore because I had, they couldn't control my, I had the hand fighting was down. So that was, you know, just took me, put me to another level.
Mm-hmm. Were you...
Then I did some judo, and I had a...
Oh, did you really?
Pac at Iowa State, did judo, so I got my arm spins and arm throws from him. And I could kill with some arm throws. I was a mean arm throw guy. I loved it.
Did you get into the foot sweeps very much? Or
a little bit, yeah.
A little bit, yeah. Those are slick. When I think about foot trips, I'm just like, man, that's like some of the highest level of grappling is like just the timing involved in just catching someone's foot right before it hits the mat. Like, it's really slick too. Like, if you're in a bar, you can really, if you have to defend yourself, like those little foot sweeps, or you can use them in a phone booth, you know?
So we had a guy on my Iowa State wrestling team who I was coaching. I can't fit his name right now, but he ended up being on the Olympic team. And so I would do a little judo with him or do a little wrestling with him. And I can remember one day I foot swept him.
Oh.
And so I was...
The judo guy.
Yeah. But then, I mean, I would go with some judo guys and they would grab my wrist and lock me out in like 5 seconds. And it was like I was completely helpless. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So.
That's interesting. You were like, I feel like there wasn't a lot of cross training back then, back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
Even now we're just starting to barely scratch the surface of cross training.
Well, Dave Schultz, who was a great... one of the greatest coaches we had in America. He was, I don't know if you know his story.
Mm-hmm.
He was into jiu-jitsu and all kind of fighting arts. And so,
okay.
You know, and that was sort of what he brought to the table too. And
so you, just to go back to the folk style freestyle things, it's something I'm just interested in.
Yeah.
Would you recommend that the American collegiate system just adopt the freestyle rules?
Sure.
Yeah. Do you think that hurt the fan base or?
No. Well, let's put it this way. Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, the rules are so screwy right now. So they are so, how would I say it, directed towards not allowing people not to score. When you start making people, you let people put their head down, you go and eliminate scoring. And, you know, scoring is what is
makes
entertaining.
It fun. Yeah.
And for me, with mixed martial arts being so popular now, I was always under the impression that if they made the wrestlers keep their head up now, wrestling would have more interest because you would see the arm throws and the trips, and the stuff that people, that everybody now can identify with because of the mixed martial arts, because of UFC and all those guys.
That's a fair point.
But, I do think, they should go to international style, but you know, everybody wants to have control of their own destiny and what they want to do. So the whole point was, we're not going to change our style for somebody in Europe, right? I mean, that's the argument.
That is a uniquely American point of view. So you're robbed of the opportunity to compete in the Olympics. You come back and win the world championships that year. Did you feel kind of vindicated at that point? Like, you kind of put the... like kind of like let that wound heal, or is that sort of kind of still tearing away? Because you sought out another Olympics years and years later.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Nothing could sort of heal that wound.
Yeah. Fair.
And obviously, I probably wouldn't have competed in '92 had I been able to compete in '80 or probably even '84. Although '84 was, you know, I don't want to denigrate anybody's medal because it shouldn't be. But 84, they didn't have half the world participate, like in 80, didn't have half the world participate. So for me, I would want to be in the Olympics where
everyone participated. And so 84, 88, you were firmly retired.
88, I had no idea. So in 84, I started working at the law firm. I graduated from law school in 87, got a job at the corporation, started working there in 88. I think in 88, had no idea that I was actually going to be wrestling again.
Could you just describe that emotional arc that you traveled sort of reluctantly, sort of, I guess, retiring and then kind of getting that fire back and figuring out that you could do it?
Well, I mean, for me, it was, so in 84, I didn't think that I would ever be, I didn't think that it would be possible for me to get a head coaching job.
Okay.
And so
you had applied to Michigan, is that correct?
I haven't applied over time to many schools.
Got it.
But I don't know that I had applied for any schools in, so this would have been 82, 83.
Okay.
But I just felt like that wasn't something that was could happen in this country. I mean, they had one guy, Bobby Douglas, but that was it. And so,
and this is going back. You didn't feel an African American was going to get a head coaching job.
Yes, but certainly not a head coaching job at a top program. No, and you know, people have told me, well, you know, you got the boosters and fundraisers, and there's no way that you're going to be able to raise funds if you're. And so, I mean, that was the environment I was living in. Whether that's true or not is a whole different story, right?
Sure.
But I didn't feel it was at the time. So I wanted, and I was, and I knew what poverty was about. So I decided, you know, I'm going to go to law school. So I went to law school basically so to prevent from being poor. I mean, I had trained myself pretty hard all the way up to 84 and had injuries and nothing else to show for it, right?
No.
I was a world champion and basically was broke. So so then I went to law school, and then in 88 I was, you know, working in an in-house corporation, didn't anticipate wrestling. And then in 89 I started working as Mark Kerr had this kid who, you know, who needed some direction. And so it was a good fit for me to have a young kid, and it was a good fit for him to have somebody who really was a wrestler, right? I mean, because he got to wrestle with one of the best guys in the world as a college kid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started to get that hunger. I figured, well, I could get beat again. Because at the time, I thought I would get hurt every
week. Well, Kerr was smashing everybody at the time, too.
And no, if you're, he wasn't.
No. Well, in MMA, I was...
Yeah, oh, in MMA, I'm not sure.
Yeah, in MMA, he was a world champion in MMA.
Yeah.
But he wasn't the most gifted wrestler?
He was one of the most athletic individuals I've ever wrestled against.
Okay.
But he wasn't disciplined enough to be successful.
Interesting.
And I think that's what I helped him with, you know, to get him, you know, to say, this is what you have to do to be successful. You have to train consistently. We've got to work out twice a day. You got to make sure that we drill and practice our technique and so on. And I'd make sure that he did it. And in making sure that he did it, I was doing it too.
Got it.
And so we helped each other, basically.
Got it. Yeah, no, see, he had, I think he'd actually won the Abu Dhabi championships.
Now, yeah, so I'm...
But that's grappling, right?
Like, here's what I'm talking. So this time period would be 84 to...
Okay,
so
got it.
So he didn't do mixed martial arts until he left college.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I was working with Mark before college.
Okay.
Or and, during college.
But that made you feel like you could come back.
Well, I wasn't getting hurt.
Yeah.
And you know, like I say, I'm one of those guys, you know, I'll wrestle here, there. You got a mat, someone put it down, I'll wrestle. I remember I went to, it must have been about five years ago. I went to Iowa and we were out at a meet, and the meet was over, and I was standing around on the mat, and this guy comes up to me, the kid comes up to me, he's at my weight class, he goes, you know, Chris Campbell, I always wanted to wrestle, you know, to think about it. And I was like, well, there's a mat, let's go. You know, and he looked at me like, you know, but that was sort of the mentality that I had, and a lot of guys I had, that we just wanted to go.
Yeah.
So if I could go, I was going to go. So again, I was shocked that I wasn't getting hurt. And then I tried to compete.
The second time around for the 92 Olympics, you have to change up your training protocol and sort of acknowledging that you'd aged a bit, or?
Well, you know, the techniques had changed so quite a bit, so I had to become familiar with the technique. I couldn't train as hard as I could have when I was 26. So I had to figure, you know, how many days a week I could wrestle. You know, if I really got beat down and I couldn't recover, maybe I could only like wrestle twice a week.
Oh, wow.
You know, because, you know, my recovery, I just didn't have it.
Okay.
You know, and so I had to. That was, I think, the hardest thing to figure out, that balance with that.
How were you able to get?
So I didn't cut weight either, because, you know, if you cut any weight, you'd be exhausted. So I wrestled a weight class higher.
Okay. When you, how did you make sure to get in all the training and mat time that you would need to prepare for the Olympics, with only being able to really do it maybe three times a week? Do you just have to be like really judicious about how you're going to spend your time, or?
Well, when I say, so if I'm wrestling hard, I would only wrestle hard maybe if you know, once, especially from really in a training hard period, my body breaks down, I could only wrestle hard maybe twice a week.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean I couldn't drill and walk through the wrestling positions, walk through the move. And drilling is really important. People don't put enough emphasis on it. But, you know, going through the step-by-step of each move, making sure your body's balanced, making sure your head's in the right place, you know, making sure you're executing it in slow motion and doing it, and then maybe a little faster and then a little faster, but mostly slow motion, and make sure everything is right in your technique so that when you hit the technique, you don't have anything out of place, your arms or your elbows, your head. Everything is in the right place. Mm-hmm. That's critical. So in some respects, it could be helpful, because I had to spend a lot more time doing that. And then I would, you know...
Would you say you're a little wiser?
Wiser. I don't know if that ever accused me of that.
Well, it just sounds like you were just very methodical about it.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, my wife at the time and some of my coaches had to come and say to me, okay, Chris, we can tell you're exhausted. You know, don't wrestle today. Because when I went to the Olympic trials, I mean, or the Olympic Games, start training for them, you know, I wanted to wrestle, you know, 4 days a week. I figured I got to wrestle at least 4 days a week. And, you know, after the first week or two, you know, I could barely move. So I had to really, and it was my wife and the coaches that say, well, Chris, maybe you shouldn't be wrestling today.
Yep.
We'll cut it down. Some days only wrestle twice a week.
When you came back the second time, much of your old cohort was gone, maybe aged out of the sport.
Different guys, yeah.
Different guys, right?
Yeah.
And you were probably, like, you were in Iowa, you were like the, you know, one of the handful of black guys on the team. Mm-hmm. Later on, you're like probably the only guy, 37, 38,
yeah, yeah.
You know?
Right.
So it was something kind of special about you in the room.
They called me Grandpa. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I was called Grandpa. It was, for me, it was my haven, you know, just being able to go in the wrestling room. If I could do anything in the world, I mean, going in the wrestling room is the thing I would do, right?
Got it.
So I was just in heaven.
So what were take us through the 92 Olympics that were in Barcelona?
Yep, they were in Barcelona. So
how many matches did you have?
I had five matches. And I had the defending Olympic and world champion the very first match. And there's a funny story. So when I made the Olympic team, the rules were that when you got called for stalling, I'm not sure what they did for stalling, but they didn't put you down. So, and okay. Mat wrestling. So the whole time from 88 through 92, I had never done a bunch of freestyle mat wrestling, which involved a lot of turns.
Right,
and then you
right.
had to know the defenses for those turns.
Right.
Like the week before the Olympic Games, they changed the rule to allow this turning, which was really unheard of, because you don't, you know, you want to have the rules, the quad leading up to the tournament, the same as should. So they changed it, which was a severe disadvantage for me, because I hadn't developed all the technique. So when I went out to wrestle Kardashev, who was the defending world champion and the defending Olympic gold medalist, you know, when I got called for stalling, you know, they put me down and he turned me like a top. So I lost that match to him 7-0, I think it was, something like that. That was my first match. And then after that, and so when you do that, you sort of go into a loser bracket.
Yeah.
So the best I could do was get the bronze medal. And then I think the second match I had was a guy from New Zealand who was basically a high school wrestler. Was, you know, I brutalized him. And then I had a guy from Japan who's named Oda who got two silver medals in the Olympics the 2 years before that.
Wow.
And I beat him out. And then my next match, which was the most fulfilling, was a guy from Cuba. The guy from Cuba had wrestled in the Pan American Games. He beat me in the Pan American Games in Cuba, and I can remember basically I slipped on the mat on some wet water, and he got a takedown, and so he won. And they were celebrating. You know, they had the band marching out in Cuba and so forth. Yeah. You know, in 1991 in the World Championships, I had beat Kardashev, who was a defending world champion, to get the medal. I beat him in the preliminary rounds. And then I had one match to go before I was going to go into the finals again. And all I ever wanted to do was be a world champion again. And I got this Cuban guy. And then he beat me by pushing me out of bounds, getting to 1 point. That knocked me out. So I got fifth there. So in the Olympic Games, we were there. And my match with him was before the for being able to get into the medal match, the bronze. And I beat him in an overtime. And then that put me into the bronze medal match, and a guy from Mongolia, and then we went into overtime too.
Oh, wow.
And I beat him in overtime match. So I was 37 beating these young kids in overtime, which I got a great feel from.
Right? Yeah, you'd expect the older guy to maybe putter out in overtime.
Yeah, man, my mind, there's no way they would have to kill me to give up anything. I'd have been on my last leg. That just was my frame of mind.
You know? Yeah, you had this. Big corporation behind you. You had some name ID because of your story was so unique.
Yeah. I found that a little distracting.
Did you?
Yeah. I had a little bit concerned with that. I wish I would have handled it better, because at the Olympic Games I said I don't want to talk to the media, because I was afraid that would affect my focus. I should have talked to the media.
Right? Yeah.
That I messed up on. But I got bad advice too. But but no, it was a little bit distracting, and I was concerned it was getting in my head, and I didn't want it to get in my head like, you know, you're somebody. I wanted to be focused on the here and now.
Got it. Yeah, because I saw an interview with you on YouTube, and you were at the I think it was like the New York State Intersectional Wrestling Championships. And they like brought you on like you were 38 and you were getting ready for another tournament. It was after the Olympics.
Yeah,
you know. But it seemed like such a cool story that you kind of maybe would have gotten some name ID and some attention. And I was wondering what that was like, you know, balancing all those things together.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a little time. I had my 15 minutes of fame, right?
Yeah.
There was a little time when anywhere I went into the country, people were recognized me, because they had me an article in Sports Illustrated, and I was in, you know, the New York Times and a lot of magazines. I don't think it was People too. So they did cover me, because not only was I older, but I was, you know, had an Ivy League law degree, and so I was this kind of thing that people thought was positive.
Yeah. You actually kept wrestling after the Olympics.
I wrestled.
After the 92 Olympics.
I wrestled in the it was in the national championships. And actually, I think I broke my neck during period of time. And I didn't know it. And so at the national tournament, I got second. And I couldn't push off with my right arm, you know. And basically, I got called for stalling, for stepping out of bounds, because I couldn't push off. So then I went to the doctors, and they took x-rays and said, you broke your neck. It's fortunate you had good, strong muscles, because they held your neck together. So I'm fused in four places.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And that was it.
So
then you settled comfortably into the desk job.
I don't know if comfortably.
Yeah, reluctantly,
never,
maybe.
No. You know, I would love to be as good an attorney as I was a wrestler. I just never
I'm sure
had
a fine
the
attorney.
Passion to do that. Because if I was as good an attorney as I was a wrestler, you know, I'd be worth millions. And, you know, I'm not. I mean, I'm just not.
Okay.
And so, you know, you have to deal with your mediocrity. But, you know, I got to survive. I got bills to pay.
Yeah. So there's a, that's actually interesting. Like, on my way to work at the state capitol, there's like a little memorial for the Purple Heart veterans, you know? And it says, you know, to those who have seen combat, life has a flavor the protected will never know. You know, and kind of the same sentiment for like high level athletes. Like after they're done, everything's just kind of. Or, you know, actually, I had a good friend of mine who's no longer with us. Come back from a lot of intense combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he actually killed himself. I think because of it. But one thing that he said to me was like, you know, nothing's quite as exciting, you know. So did you struggle with that, like when you finally retired?
Still am. I don't think. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, competing in a lifestyle that competing gives you, traveling around the world and meeting new people and beating them up. Right? It doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, then you got to go to the same job, sit at a desk and have somebody, you know, yelling at you or screaming at you. It's just like, oh, I could just snap your neck. You know?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it can be very depressing, and I've gone through, I've gone through like 5-10 year periods of time where the fact that I just was not happy with life.
Got it. So you're looking back instead of trying to forward or something like that?
Just because I'm not, I mean, when I was wrestling, competing, you know, I don't know, life was interesting and it was exciting.
Right.
After it, not so much. And so what am I gonna get up, do the same thing every day, look at the same contract every day, the same language. I mean, you know, at a certain point you're like, I mean, not that I'd ever want to do it, but you feel like blowing your brains out, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's just like, oh, this is just, life is too short for this.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that's fair.
But
that's
you gotta work, you gotta survive.
You gotta survive, right? You got a family, you got kids.
And... Yeah, so you go from a situation where you're pursuing your passion to a situation where you're just struggling to survive, which is different. It really is a little bit emotionally deflating.
Yeah, yeah, I'll bet. Yeah. So do you, I think we're past the point now where an African-American can take a head coaching job at a top tier school. Mm-hmm. Is that something that interests you at all still? Or like maybe go back or work your, I mean, you've got the skill set, you've got the knowledge, you've got the passion. Have you ever thought about trying to get a coaching position?
No.
Or do you feel like that's you tried and it passed? And
I'm past it because I got so many injuries. To me, in order to be a good coach, you've got to be able to get down and show a person what they're doing wrong. And, you know,
like Gable was in the wrestling with you guys.
Oh, Gable was in wrestling. Now, I didn't necessarily have to be wrestling with the guys every day, but I feel I do need to be able to execute the technique properly to show them how to do it. And I should be running with them and weightlifting so that they understand the seriousness of training, conditioning. And I couldn't do any of that.
Got it. You ever just go around to the high schools and just kind of offer to help out?
Sure. I don't offer to help out because you can be intimidating. So if I'm, you know, this Olympic wrestler, world champion, it could be intimidating to coaches. So I don't offer my help. If somebody asks, then I'll come and help them. But
got it. Getting a little bit over an hour here. I think I've asked you pretty much everything that I've wanted to pick your brain about. That, you know, thanks again for taking the time. You know, just kind of final thoughts. What advice would you have to sort of young wrestlers coming up now?
Well, it's interesting because it's sort of an experience I have with my daughter. Well, with the young wrestlers coming up, make sure you're always learning different stuff. So I would say a young wrestler coming up should do judo, jiu-jitsu, and everything else. I mean, you want to learn all the fighting styles. That would be what I would say. But, I mean, I would also say if it's not your passion, don't do it. Because I understand a little bit more now about my passion because I had a passion. I didn't realize it when I was in it. But I do now. I had a passion, and that passion was what made me successful. So I would always say, make sure you pursue your passion. You know, that's what I would say.
Very cool. Very cool. I'm gonna actually isolate that and make it its own clip. Thank you for that.
Yeah.